Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Are mai. Welcome to the Master Toast On Air, your go-to show for all things Toastmasters in the greater Wellington region. We are broadcasting here from RFM studio in the region of the Wairarapa in Aotearoa. Aotearoa is the Maori name for New Zealand, and it sounds really cool. So if you're listening from far away, repeat Aotearoa 10 times to memorize it. And add this as a quiz question next time you have one. Today, join us as we spotlight our incredible members diving into their passions, interests, and exciting personal projects. Welcome to episode 7. And my name is Geraldine Durrant, and I have the pleasure to welcome one of our amazing and speech contest winner member, Braden Crocker. Welcome, Braden.
Hello, welcome. It's good to be here. Thank you.
Great. And you've got something exciting to talk to us about today.
Yes, today I was going to talk to you all about my time when I went to Africa after leaving university and working on a black rhino research project.
That sounds exciting. So when did that happen?
This is going back a few haircuts now. This is going 15 years ago. I did this, yeah. It's been a while.
But it did kind of stuck to you, like, yep, as a life experience, and yep, you want to share the world about that.
Yes, I'd love to tell everybody about this.
Okay. It'd be great. Fantastic. So what happened?
Alrighty, so just to give you a little bit of background, I've always been keen on wildlife, and I grew up in a little town in Taihape on a farm. So I was out of town there. There's a place called Omatani. It was a beautiful little valley. Growing up there, I loved going out on the farm and helping Dad with the animals, and there was always, you know, things to chase, and I was always keen on wildlife and that sort of thing. I would spend a lot of time going up into, we had the Ruahini Ranges, which backed onto our property, and I'd always sneak up there with my little dog and try and see if I can see deer or pigs and that sort of thing. So it was always been a passion for me to spend time in the wilderness, and Africa was the holy grail for me. I always wanted to go to Africa, and ever since I was a little kid, it was always my goal. When I went to university and I tried to do vet and didn't quite make it, so the second best thing was to carry on with a zoology degree. And while I was there, I met some pretty cool people, and one of my lecturers that was there in my third year, he was a ungulate, like large animal lecturer, and he was going to Africa to do some work for San Diego Zoo. They fund wildlife research projects throughout the world, and he got some funding to go to Africa, and I got wind of this and I learnt about it. And I ended up getting in touch with him, said, hey, can I come over and come and help you out? Do you need a helper? And he said, yeah, that's fine. And so I went through the process of, I had to, you know, get visas and so forth, and I was all excited. And then, yeah, then the time came for me to head over to Africa, and it was amazing. Went over there, and I was working in Namibia, and in Namibia, there's big farms. It's so dry, you know. It's, you go over there, their winter time, they don't see any rain. There they get rain in November through to December, and I left New Zealand, I think it was maybe April, so it was just starting to get cold and wet, and went over there, and it was dry. Everything was so brown. There's no water anywhere, and it's such a stark contrast from New Zealand, you know. It's so green and wet, and over there so brown and dry. Went over there, and I was working in there's a big national park called Etosha National Park, and it's got a great big salt pan in the middle of it. And every year in November, December, fills up with water, this big salt pan, and there's flamingos and all that. But anyway, I was working on these big farms right next door to the Etosha National Park, and so these farms were wildlife tourist hunting, sort of tourist slash hunting hunting properties, and they had the plan that if they could have these rhinos put on eventually when they start breeding up, they could possibly hunt them. And the issue was there was in a national park in South Africa, Umfolozi National Park, they had too many black rhinos. The population had reached a saturation point, and they'd stopped breeding. So basically, rhinos are very hormone driven. So when they won't start, the females won't cycle, and they won't reproduce if there's the population density so much that there's hormones everywhere controlling their breeding, basically. And so what we did is we would go in, dart them, put them on a horse float, take them up into Namibia and into these big custodian farms, put them in a big cattle yard. So the cattle yards are pretty heavily built. They're built with railway irons and, yeah, very robust. And we'd hold them there for 2 weeks while the anaesthetic would wear off. We'd hold them there. We'd collect their dung. So they would. That was interesting times, just trying to get in and get the dung before you got trampled by this rhino. So we'd collect the dung. And what happens is, just a bit of an aside there from collecting the dung, there would be what would happen is when we let the rhino out of their yards, they would run off and think that the whole property, big properties like their, you know, 100,000 hectare properties, big properties, and they would make the whole place their own there, because no other rhinos were there. So that was their whole territory. And then when you let a second rhino out, another male rhino, they would try, they'd have to fight to get some territory. So what we would do is we were trying to influence where they set up their territories by collecting their dung, and then we'd make it into a slurry, and we would drive around and flung their dung. And then once we let them out of their enclosure, they'd take off and they'd find where their dung is, and they'd feel familiar and they'd think, oh yeah, this is my territory. So that's what that was the research project that we were working on, was to try and see if we could influence where they went. And yeah, the problem was when two bull rhinos, because these are black rhinos and they're quite rare, if they can't, they'll fight. Often they'll hurt themselves, but they could kill each other. So yeah, you're trying to save a endangered species. So if you can influence where they set up their territory so they don't fight, that's a win. Once we'd released these rhinos, we had to do some, the project was to keep tracking them down and see where they went and whether they'd spend more time in those areas that we set up with the rhino dung. What we did when the rhino was unconscious, when we darted them, we would put a drill into their horn and put a transmitter in so we can find them again. And also we would have a sand bushman tracker. So those are the little short people that live naturally, occurred in the Kalahari Desert, and they would, so we would have sometimes two of these sand bushmen helping me track these rhinos, and it was really cool. They're really neat people, really happy people, and I enjoyed their company. The only struggle was that they didn't speak English at all well, and I couldn't speak their language. Hottentot was what they spoke. And so there's a lot of clicking and that sort of stuff, very hard dialect to learn under what I think anyway. And so we compromised and I learned some Afrikaans, and so yeah, we could communicate that way. What I did to learn Afrikaans is I bought these little kids' books, and at night time around the fire, I'd read the Afrikaans books to Andreas, who was one of the sand bushman guys, and he would... you know, through sign language, explain what each word meant, and I'd write it in English underneath. And gradually, I was able to have some reasonably low-level conversations, simple conversations with this guy. And often, quite often, actually, I was left with him for months on end, to follow these rhinos around. And yeah, so it was really good. Like, we would go to, we'd start off, sometimes if we couldn't find the rhino, we would just go to the water holes and pick up their prints. And these sand bushmen are incredible trackers. Like, they can see stuff that I couldn't see. And we would be going over, you'd pick up the prints and you'd follow them, and then you'd get to a rocky plateau area where you might go for a kilometre or so without seeing any muddy bits where there's prints. And it was incredible. They'd still find them. And, you know, I'd say Andreas did the rhino fleck, which means the rhino flew, and he'd be like, no, that rock's upside down. And I was like, how do you know which way the rock's supposed to be, you know? So it was incredible. It was really, really incredible following these rhinos, and it was never shy of any adventure. Every day was exciting for me, and I taught them to drive, and that was interesting, because I used to stand on the roof with this radio to pick up the rhino's transmitter and his horn, and I'd try to teach Andreas to drive a manual. And that was, so I'd stand on the top of this Land Rover Defender and try and balance, and he'd drive around, and I'd be with these little earphones on and try and pick up the beeps from its transmitter. And sometimes, yeah, it was interesting. For a start, there was lots of heavy braking and, you know, clutch getting dropped quite quickly, and I'd fall off the back. And, yeah, but he got pretty good in the end. We would head out. So most days we'd head out, try and track down these rhinos, and you'd follow them and see where they've been. So basically he would backtrack where they went, and I'd record it through GPS so we could track where they've been, and we had also pre-recorded where we'd flung the dung. So, yeah, you could tell whether they're spending more time in those territories or not, and it was showing that they were spending more time there. So hopefully I was making a difference with this rhino flung dung work we were doing. And yeah, so there's never shy of any adventures. We'd often be chased, and I'll tell you a few stories regarding that. There was one day we were out up into these mountains on one property, and it's quite heavily forested, and we were walking in close to where the rhino was. I could pick up the transmitter on my earphones, and basically as you get closer you wind down the volume, and that gives you an indication of how far away it is. So if you wind it down to, you know, 2 or whatever, it's like 200 meters, and then 1 is 100 meters away. And so eventually you get to a point where you indicate to the sand bushman tracker, who was Andreas at this time, and he would take the lead. And we also had, this particular time, we had a lady who was working with us, and she was like an intern and just come out for the experience. She was a South African lady as well. And yeah, we got in close. Andreas was in front of me, and I just was quite close in behind him, and just the usual day, normal routine. And Andreas stopped all of a sudden. We could hear a bit of crashing around in the bushes, thick bushes. And I thought it was a bit unusual, because the rhinos don't usually make that much noise. Anyway, I took my earphones off and just stood there, and Andreas walked in, and then he stopped all of a sudden, and he just stopped real still, you know, and he's acting real strange. And I started to wonder what was going on, and then he all of a sudden just ran off. And I looked through the trees and I could see an elephant with its ears up and its trunk out, you know, trying to pinpoint what we were, you know, were we a predator? And poaching was a real thing over in Africa, in Namibia there anyway. And so elephants did have a hatred for humans. And we got in close. I could see this elephant standing there. Andreas had taken off, and I could see the intern. She was unaware of the situation. And one other thing that Andreas had told me in the evenings when I was sitting around the fire is how dangerous elephants are. And, you know, I always thought, you know, a big friendly jumbo, you know, come and give them a pat or whatever. But no, they can be really, really dangerous. They can kill you easily. And he had a friend that was killed, And so he had a real concern, you know, respect for them. And so I was trying to indicate to this lady, you know, that there's an elephant there, and she was busy writing up the date and getting all ready, you know, we're coming, this is Casper the rhino. And yeah, it was very, very tense moment. And as soon as she saw through sign language from me that I was indicating an elephant, and she, being a South African, she had a pretty good respect for elephants, and so she took off too. And at that point, the elephant had had enough of trying to search where this predator, you know, where we were, and charged forward. And I was pretty close to being directly in front of it, but fortunately, it's something that I do in terror, you know, like when you're in that moment when you're gonna die potentially, you know, people, you know, they freeze or they run or they fight or whatever. Well, I think I'm a freezer because I just froze there. I thought, because I knew I couldn't outrun it and I couldn't outclimb it, and I just thought, well, I'm just going to stay right here. And it brushed past me and then just charged, carried on off, and probably, you know, Ruth and Andreas probably saved me by them running off in that direction. And if I just staying really still, the elephant couldn't pinpoint me. I hadn't moved, and it could only smell when your scent is not really that directional. So it was lucky, and I got away, survived that one. And it was one of those times when you really do think you are going to die, you know, that's the end of it. And but yeah, it turned out all right.
So you're pretty good at being a tree then.
Yes,
from what I guess.
Very, very good at staying very still. There's other times when you're working in areas where there's not a lot of thick, tall trees, and everything's prickly as, like, you have these camel thorn bushes or acacia bushes that are, it's like a rose bush on steroids, and it's also got not just hooks but points, spikes as well. And often when you're working with the rhinos, because they don't have very good eyesight, but their sense of smell is pretty amazing, you can actually, you know, work quite close to them. And I used to try and predict which way they were heading, and you know, stand in that position so they're walking away from me, and I'll record what they do. Pretty boring stuff, you know, like they're eating an acacia bush or they're scraping the ground, and you got to write all this down. So I'd record all this, but yeah, unfortunately the rhino turned and started walking towards me, and before I knew, I was in a position that I was only behind like a small bush, like only like a meter wide bush, and it's just me and the bush, and the tree that I could potentially climb is a long way away. And to climb any tree, you really got to be pressured pretty hard, because you're going to get hooked and stabbed and everything as you climb the tree, by the tree, or, you know, the risk of getting trampled by the rhino. So you're sort of weighing it up all the time. And for me, so I was sort of in my little island behind the tree, and the rhino came very close to the bush, and it stopped and it knew something was up. And once again, poachers had got them very nervous, and they had no respect for humans. And this particular rhino just stood there, and I thought, man, this is another moment, you know, that I could get trampled or, you know, stabbed with the horn. And fortunately, the tracker Andreas, he had climbed a tree not far from me, and he climbed back down and he picked up this stone and he rubbed it under his arm, and then he threw it over into the bushes beyond me. And the rhino heard and could smell the scent, and it just chased off after that scent and that sound as well. And so Andreas saved me. And but it wasn't the end of that rhino. He ran off, and because he's so angry, he tracked where we'd been, tracked us all the way to where our truck was, the Land Rover Defender, and he stuck his horn through the tyre, the front tyre, but that wasn't the end of it. He also caught his horn on the wheel arch and lifted the front of the Land Rover Defender around, you know, a couple, maybe 5 metres around. So they're very strong animals. They can weigh up to, you know, 1.2 tonnes, and so they're powerful animals, not to be messed with. And that was, yeah, so those are few of the adventures that I've had with the rhinos and the elephants. And there's probably one other event that I could tell you about if I've got time. got time?
Just about. We're getting close to end time, but yeah.
Okay, so
it's so fascinating. I'm sure everybody's like, we want to know the next story.
Okay, well, my brother came over to see me. He came over from New Zealand, and he met me, and we went up into Zimbabwe, and we went for a paddle down the Zambezi River. And so I just found a local guy and paid him some money for the hireage of this canoe. And it was a bit of an adventure, really. And we canoed down, no idea what we're doing, basically. And a few things that, you know, pieces of wisdom that locals have told us is when you're paddling down, as you whack the paddle on the canoe, and it reverberates through the river, and hippos are very territorial, and they will attack you, and they would stick their heads up, and so you can see where they are, and then you paddle away from them. And yeah, one day there, so we went down for a week, paddled down the Zambezi for a week, and we one day there, just a big storm came, like a big just a thunderstorm came and poured this rain, heavy as, and we had all our gear in the front, and we quickly packed it up and tried to beeline it for the shore. And it's a big wide river, you know, like it's probably, you know, a kilometre wide in this section. We were in the middle, and so we're paddling like crazy for this shore, and we forgot to bang on the kayak, the canoe, and we didn't, and it was too late, and the hippo stuck its head up. There's a whole herd of hippos, I suppose, is what you call them, and they stuck their heads up, and the bull hippo came charging for us, and you could see its head was up above the water, and then it dropped below the water, and then you see this bow wave just coming for you, and my brother was in the front, and I said, mate, you paddle, man, we've got to paddle. So we started paddling like crazy, and the hippo came up under us and lifted the canoe up. And I'd heard stories, you know, not just that elephants can kill you, but the hippos can chomp you in half and that sort of thing. So yeah, I had that fear, that respect for them. And fortunately, the hippo was going straight for us, and we had so much momentum on that we went up over its head and slid down the other side and carried on to the shore. And then with so much momentum, we were paddling like we'd never paddled before, and carried on up the bank, halfway up the bank, and leapt out, climbed a tree, and the hippo sort of ran around, fortunately didn't wreck our canoe, pushed it over, but yeah, didn't destroy anything, so that was good, because we would have been stranded in the middle of the Zambezi River with no means of transport. So yeah, those are a few things, but there's lots of adventures, and I'd never regret any moment of being over there. It was you know, really, really interesting for me. So I was there for a year and a half, and really enjoyed it.
Wow. So. Well, that's an adventure in itself, just listening to you, and like quite nerve-wracking at times when you think Braden is gone.
Yeah.
But he's still here, so we're lucky we didn't lose you there. And obviously zoology has been experience just in Namibia, or did you carry it on after? Did you go anywhere else?
No, I've just been to Namibia. I've spent a bit of time in Australia and that sort of thing, but not working with animals like that.
How long were you there for?
I was in Namibia for a year and a half.
Wow, okay. Yeah. And three occasions you almost done.
There were numerous other occasions, and actually the biggest sort of danger that I really when I felt I was really in danger was with people, really. We were, one guy tried to mug us with a knife. And another thing is the police over there in Namibia are quite corrupt. So, you know, you end up having to pay bribes and those sorts of things. So, yeah, it wasn't those sorts of things. It's unique. You know, like New Zealand, you don't experience any of these. But over there it was quite commonplace. So.
Sounds like the animals were not that dangerous after all.
No, so you've got to watch out for the people as well. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Braden. Thank you for coming today and tell us all about that. And that made episode 7 of Master Toast on Air, presented by our community group, Toastmaster Warapa in Aotearoa. Aotearoa, which is New Zealand. Yes, Braden mentioned it a few times that we are in New Zealand here. So you got that. Whether you're looking to improve public speaking, develop leadership abilities, or simply meet new people, Toastmasters exists all over the world and offers a welcoming environment for everyone. So now that you've had a taste of Master Toast on Air, why not check out on our live meetings? If you're in the Warrapa, you can find us on Toastmasters Warrapa Facebook page.